Okay, welcome everyone. My name is Claire Gilman, and I'm the curator of Drawn from Photography. And with me here today are four of the artists from the show, Emily Prince, Carl Handel, Andrea Bowers, and Richard Forster. And I'm going to turn things over to them in a few minutes. But first, I wanted to say a few words about the show. So basically, the idea for this show came about from my kind of being out there and seeing art and discovering what I began to consider a trend on the part of
strength.
Turn my phone off. That just occurred to me. And seeing what I began to think of as a trend among young artists working in drawing, which is essentially the meticulous, very labor-intensive, hand-drawn rendering of photographs and photo-based media. And I also observed that a lot of the artists that are working in this way tend to draw on themes related to political and social transformation, some more directly, some more indirectly. And I mean, that's not exclusively the case. There are other artists working today drawing from photographs that have nothing to do with that. But I did notice that this seemed to kind of come up again and again. And so that's what I decided to focus this show on. I mean, that very pairing in itself was interesting to me. And I began to ask, why, first of all, adopt such a kind of rote mechanistic procedure as copying to describe images depicting change? And second of all, why make drawings after photographs, you know, in doing this rather than making drawings from life? So, you know, those were some of the questions that I really tried to answer as I put this show together, and I think that I have come up with some of my own thoughts about this, but I think I will turn things over to the artists and let them talk to you about their process and their projects, you know, in the context of this show. So each of the artists is going to speak for about, you know, 10 minutes or so. Then we are going to have a conversation among ourselves, and then I'm going to open things up to the audience. So Emily is going to go first.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so yeah, that's a perfect place to start. So this is my work that you can see on this wall right here, and has a long title. It's American Servicemen and Women Who've Died in Iraq and Afghanistan, but not including the wounded, nor the Iraqis, nor the Afghans. And this is just an abridged version of it. And it all started in 2004, so I've been working on this project for about 7 years now, and I continue to work on it. And there's a little margin of open space on the right here, and I'll be sending new drawings that will be installed over the course of the exhibit. So what you're looking at are portraits of individual military servicemen and women who've died in the wars that were engaged in Iraq and Afghanistan. In my broader work, I tend to be interested in how we as humans respond to the passage of time and the work that we do to make memory and what we do to mark things that are gone and how we memorialize. And I became interested in this subject specifically because growing up, you hear about war through your history classes or reading it in books or seeing movies, and it seems like this enormous and intense thing that I always wondered, like, what does that feel like to when the country you live in is at war? And then when it happened and we went into Afghanistan and then Iraq, because I don't know anybody actually enlisted in the military, it honestly felt like almost nothing, because it's so easy to remain disassociated from it. And that gulf surprised me, and disturbed me. And so I wanted to have some kind of personal practice by which I had, if I wasn't involved with it in a real way, I at the very least had a higher degree of awareness of what was happening. And so I, as someone who draws, I started making these portraits of the people who, the Americans who were dying, as a way of illuminating the specific details behind the abstraction of statistics, because I found those numbers just a summary and very unsatisfying. And in doing this, it became this ritual for me that is an elongation of the gaze, and so I'm spending about an hour with each one of these pictures, so it's not like just seeing them in the newspaper at a glance, but really poring over it and almost meditating on this image, just as a way to have like a correlation in my life to the war that's happening, because it's so easy to remain separate from it, and that is uncomfortable for me. I think that this brings up one of the issues that all of this work has in common, which is that the drawing, the act of drawing, indicates time spent, because to me that was the whole point of doing this, to spend time with these images. So I think that the act of drawing implies time, and it also implies labor. And I think that it's relevant to do it because it's a deliberate slowing down of the processing of information. And I think that that is a direct, at least for me personally, a direct response to the like ever-quickening availability of media. And it's almost a gesture of protest to that, and wanting to slow down the processing of this kind of heavy information. And the copying is interesting because it brings up a funny question, like why these images already exist in the world, why reproduce them? And I think that the copying itself implies a desire for repetition and a need to draw out and lengthen the process of absorbing this information. And I think it indicates that just a quick glance does not suffice. And I think that that experience for the artist also has an equivalent to the experience of the viewer, because you see the mark making. I know that, like myself, looking at the other drawings in the show, my drawings are more sketchy, but particularly drawings like Andrea Bauer's, for instance, that are so incredibly labor intensive. And you know that it's a drawing, you know that it's a photograph. It's not a photograph, rather. And I think that that mark making itself, can you understand in a very visceral way that that equals time spent. Oh, yeah. So just to explain, these are different installations that I've done with this work. What you're seeing is a chronological display. This is the last year's worth of drawings. Like I said, I've been doing it since 2004. These are geographical installations. Here's a detail. This is up on the wall right now. It's another detail. You'll notice there's just a couple now, but there's some drawings, if you look, that just have a blank square, and that's because there was no picture available where I get at my resource, which is a military website that collects this information, pictures, and whatever newspaper articles are written about these people. And then as I started to show this piece and more people learned about it, I had some military families write to me, and we have had some conversations, and some people who supplied me with pictures when there weren't pictures available already. So this is one of those pictures that not a family but friends sent. And that this man's name is Isaac Lawson. But anyway, what I was saying before was that I think that as a viewer with a drawing that copies a photograph, you have an equivalent experience of a slowing down of your absorption of it, because you can viscerally feel the way that that drawing contains time and labor. And I think even on a cognitive level, because of the irregularity of mark making that can never be as machine-like as a photograph, it just like actually it takes longer for your brain to process. So I think that on both ends, the making of it and the viewing of it is slowed down. And do you want me to speak to art and activism? Or should we save that?
Maybe we should save that, because I think that we'll hear what everyone has to say, and then we can, you know, then we can, that can come onto the table. Do you want to just tell a little bit about, more specifically, a little bit the different colors of paper you use, and just so people understand exactly how, and how this is organized with each week?
Sure.
Oh, sorry. I was just telling Emily to, she will talk into the mic, to just tell a little bit more about the different choices of colors of paper and how this work is laid out here specifically.
Yeah, so these decisions are all very practical, I suppose. So you'll see that there are these different shades of paper, and they very basically correspond to race and ethnicity, so that you can experience this piece on both a micro level and look at individual portraits, read individual texts, or you can step away from it and absorb this kind of information that exists on a more macro level, like the racial demographics. And in some of the pictures that you saw earlier, the piece was put up to represent the geographical origins of each of these individual people. But here, it exists chronologically. So this is the last year's worth of drawings. It starts February 2010 up to January 2011. And like I said, in this empty space, we'll go drawings from this month that I'll be sending here to be put up. And it's chronological left to right. Like the Maya Lin Memorial, in a sense, except that unlike that, they're not displayed one consecutively after the other. So the open space is just a visual analogy to however sparse or dense casualties were from one week to the next. Each column is a week's time.
Great. Carl?
Hi, I'm Carl. thanks for coming. That drawing over there is the drawing I have for the in this show. It's from 2000. It's the front page of Pravda from the day I was born. And so it's, it's 11 years old. And it was like sort of the first, for the most part, my work is realistic, a lot of realistic drawing, pencil drawing for the most part, in these big installations. And there's a lot of political themes in my work, but for the most part, my work isn't specifically political, but maybe about how we come to have certain beliefs, like we as a people come to have certain ideals, define how we come to define ourselves, and it touches on, you know, a lot of psychological issues of how we come to see ourselves. So this particular drawing, I drew when I got to LA, and I had just left. I just left New York. I was in the Whitney program, which is sort of this, it's very close to here, but, and ideologically it's sort of like a group of artists who have a certain, I guess, belief in the type of art that should be made, and many of the students have similar beliefs, and I, in many ways, have those same beliefs about, I mean, they're generally left-leaning beliefs. But what I found very interesting when I was there was sort of like I can make art that expresses these leftist opinions, and the people in the art world, many of them share them and could agree with them, but that was like, it sort of was like preaching to the converted in a sense. And I was sort of more interested in how come everyone there had the same beliefs or similar beliefs and how we come to have these beliefs. So this drawing, I'm born in 1976, and everything that was talked about by a lot of my teachers at the time was all stuff in the 60s, you know, and a lot of the people we were reading were 60s writers. And I was, not only was I not born in the 60s, I was born in the 70s, and I was a baby then, so I didn't even come to fruition until long after that stuff was done. And I was trying to reconcile, like, where the U.S. is now and where I am now with a kind of history of a kind of left-leaning politics protest. And so I drew this front page of, you know, I guess communism being like the end product of a type of radical socialism and how far I was away from it. I don't understand the language. By 1976, the dream of communism was falling apart. And so it was sort of trying to reconcile where I was versus where my ideals came from. So let's go to the next one. So I'm going to show you a few slides of art that is somewhat about politics. I mean, it's not about any specific issue, but it's about how political discourse sort of functions. So I started making these protest signs in 2003, which they're repeated slogans because I was thinking of chanting. And I went to the anti-war protests, the anti-Iraq war protests in LA, and this was sort of the first, you know, I'm born in 1976, this is the first anti-war protest I attended, and I was struck by how sort of heterogeneous it was. Like, there were all different people protesting different things. We were against Bush, against this war, but the people were, there was sort of like gay marriage stuff, there was environment stuff, there was pro-choice stuff. There was a lot of different people holding signs, and then it was in Hollywood. And the line at Starbucks was really long because everyone was like stopping to get a coffee, and I got there, I joined the wrong place, and the cops were like, oh, no problem, come on in here. It was just so friendly and so not what I thought protest should have been, and almost like a parody of a protest. And I also realized it was very strange because this protest happened before the war in a way that, like, people said, this is outrageous, we should have a protest. But it's almost like the idea of that protest has been historicized and built into something that when people say, this isn't right, let's protest. So it's not an original idea, and maybe that type of protest being historicized and taught and learned by so many people becomes cliche in and of itself. So these signs were sort of about trying to take two different opposing viewpoints and putting them together in a kind of, I don't know, impossible way. You know, like, and how certain taking up, whether dogmatism of any kind, let's go to the next one, seems to sort of reify this is from an installation, I think, in 2005. It seems to keep things going. Like, if you say, let marries marry, I always heard people say, like, oh, let the gays marry. Let them suffer like the rest of us. You know, it's like there's still sex, there's still homophobia in that statement, yet, so the homophobia continues, but you can still, like, belong to a certain, you could still say, I'm for gay marriage, but you could still be homophobic. And the argument about gay marriage is not about marriage. It's really, it causes all these problems because of homophobia. So that's what I was sort of interested in. No one loves abortion. No one wants to have fetuses aborted, but it's sort of the dogmatism of the way people get pushed to the sides that I was sort of interested in. To push it, and in these signs, I was pushing it to kind of like absurdist point. Let's go to the next one. The same thing. This was a proposal for a billboard in LA. Needless to say, it was declined. But, you know, like the impossibility. This is a billboard about racism, but also how I was thinking about how Al Sharpton is portrayed as sort of like the angry black minister, and how he's portrayed as this guy who jumps onto political bandwagons that are sort of good for his career. And but then again, and then he says, I'm always portrayed as an angry black minister, but he needs to be portrayed that way to have his self-identity. So I was interested in the identities of how people are wrapped up in the things they believe in, not particularly in Al Sharpton, but in how who we are is wrapped up in our beliefs and how those beliefs are formed. Let's go to the next one. So these were the, when Claire asked if I wanted to be in the show, I probably asked her, can I be in your show? But these are the drawings. Are we good on time?
A little bit.
Okay.
A little bit.
We only have this and then this. You be
okay.
One. So these were the drawings that I wanted to put in the show, this show, which are called Soapbox Drawings. And these were also in some way about protest and about why it seems to me that political protest doesn't work in the U.S. or seems to have expired somehow. And, you know, they have a, can we go to the next one, please? They have a relationship to, you know, Andy Warhol, of course, and maybe to, like, Jeff Koons and Chaim Steinbeck, 80s consumerist art, which I really love. But, you know, the idea of the soapbox, standing on your soapbox, the preaching at the soapbox, your political beliefs, you know, shouting it out in the corner, doesn't seem to be viable anymore. And I was thinking of, and of course, Chiral, the same thing all. I mean, Chiral is, I'm thinking about protest when I'm like a crowd protesting. But I was thinking about, I think it was that when Khrushchev came to America and he went to the supermarket and he said when he saw the American supermarket, he knew the Cold War was lost. I don't know, I might have got that wrong, but I think that was the quote. And a lot of people seem to think that means that, you know, he knew that capitalism would triumph over communism. But I really think what he meant to say was that the American people are too satisfied, and a political regime or political regime cannot stand if its people are unsatisfied. And the people in communism were in the Soviet Union were not satisfied, and the American people just have too many choices and are just too satisfied, and that's why democracy works. That's the way I took that, and that's also why I often think this is just my belief, but I wonder if why. In the, you know, the Western democracies, that type of political, the thing that, like, what just happened in Cairo doesn't happen here because life is just pretty good in a lot of Western democracies. Not great, but pretty good. We have too much choice. We have, you know, and so let's go to the next one. This is the last one I'll show you. This is called 56,055, and it was almost a life-size drawing of a Cadillac Escalade, and it had some other things to do with that. The prices of a lot of young artists were like really high in 2005, mine included. They're no longer that way, but there was like a lot of demand for young artists' work, and this was only my second show, and there were other artists my age who like had prices in six figures, and I was like, I should draw this Escalade and sell it for the price of the Escalade, which is 56,055, so which was way more than, you know, like I don't know, 30. I was 30 years old or something. How long? A 30-year-old artist probably shouldn't sell art for $56,000. It didn't sell, but and I said let's reduce the price to the price, the Blue Book value of a 2005 Escalade. And so my dealer would check the price as it went down, and it sold for $50,000, like shortly after the show, because it went down a little, because the Blue Book value went down. But behind the scenes, and this is where the activist part of this drawing comes in, I was researching green charities, specifically charities or causes that were looking into alternative fuel sources, green sources. And I wanted to take half the money from this drawing and put it to secretly give it to a green charity. Because at the time I was making these drawings and it was like people with SUVs couldn't, there were these SUV engines, and I was saying like, told my dealer, don't sell it to people who own sports cars or SUVs. Because I was thinking like, is it possible to control people's mode, like control collectors' money through their desire? Like, if they want one of my drawings, can I redirect their money to a cause that I believe in? But my dealer, probably really astutely, after she sold it, she said, you know how hard it was to sell this drawing for $50,000, way more than your prices really are. I don't want to give my half to charity. And but you can give your half. So I was, but then I was like, well, I spent a lot of time on this. I don't want to do that. So I said, what if we each buy? And I realized that if I secretly gave it, the only right way to give to charity seemed to be anonymously. And if I gave it, if I said the piece, like I gave the money from this drawing to a green charity, it felt too neat. Like if I just told you that I did that, then this discussion would be over. And it wouldn't be complicated enough, because the to tell people that you give money to charity is you're buying yourself a certain social, it's like a kind of social capital. So you're trading in your monetary capital, your actual capital, for social capital. So I was like, well, I want it more messy. So we each...
Couple more minutes.
So me and my dealer each bought a Prius with the money, because two Priuses, they were about $25,000. So we each bought a Prius, because I was really thinking about how, you know, like, I do all the liberal things. I go to the farmer's market. I recycle. I vote Democratic. But those values, like buying a Prius is just putting my values on display. And I wanted to implicate my own values on display, just like if you own an SUV, you're putting a certain value on display. And I'm not really interested in the specifics of the values, but what is it about us that makes us perform who we think we are? And that's why I bought a Prius with the money, because it seemed much, much more complicated, you know? And I guess, I think that's the last one I have. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, so Andrea. I want to thank Claire for inviting me to be a part of this show and for writing about my work. I think it's an amazing article and amazing text, and it's really exciting to finally be showing at the Drawing Center. I've always wanted to show here. I just want to say, you can start with the first image. This one's in the show. My work is, it's not medium specific. I do a lot of video, sort of documentary-based video installations, work with a lot of found objects, I make books, so it's multifaceted. So I'm showing you just drawing, but the drawings are related to much bigger projects, and all of my practice is based on working with activists, or I would say big topics, and those, there's pretty much three. That would be feminism, that would be environmentalism, and issues of migration, and open border policies, more open border policies. So I don't think the art world is super progressive. I think that's a fallacy, however, if we are, that's great, and if we preach to the converted, that's genius, we need to do more of it, because the right has been so good at doing that. You know, you look at the Tea Partiers, you look at the extreme right, and that's what they do, they preach to the converted, and so I actually think it is a really good strategy. Okay, so I work with photorealist drawing, because I am trying to focus on a conceptual idea of working outside of my own subjectivity and focusing on issues outside of myself. So these come from the world. This references a photo that already exists. I did not make this up in my head. It is not about my interior psychological thinking or interpretation. Okay, so this is an early piece that's in the show. I was doing a lot of work that was focusing on really intense organizing that required a lot, nonviolent civil disobedience that required a lot of organizing with a lot of people. And I wanted to think about nonviolence as an everyday activity, as a feminist activity, as a gender expansive activity. So this is a transvestite smoking in a bathroom stall where it says no smoking. So it's like, we can do this every day. We can protest every day in little ways. Okay, next. They're color in black and white based on what the photograph is. Next. This was my some of my first political work was based on a group of three women activists called the Army of Three in San Francisco. They're in their 80s right now. They were some of the most radical activists trying to make abortion legal in this country. One of the things that they did was they created a list of doctors, particularly in Mexico, who would give women safe abortions, and they would travel to Mexico and research those doctors. This is before the internet. Women and men from all over the United States would write to them for this list of doctors. So you have to imagine, you know, no internet, no email, just begging that this letter would be responded to, and they responded to every letter. This was a tabling event that they did. You can next slide. This is a detail of it. This is a color pencil drawing. This was a tabling event that they did in 1966, I believe, at a conference for doctors. They were trying to get doctors to support women's rights, women's health care rights, women's rights to abortion. So Pat McGinnis, one of the activists, gave me this out of her, this picture out of her, you know, she had just her files. Next. I was thinking about the fact that there's this conception or this understanding that modernism, that there's like a neutrality. When I was in school, it was like there was art that was like art with a capital A that was somehow neutral. And then there was all the rest of us, the political artists, the African-American artists, the feminist artists. You know, we were like somehow the other or something, wherever the other, there was some neutral, there was some sense that there was some neutral art form. So I was trying to play with modernist compositions, and I was inserting pro-choice pins into them to remove the neutrality of modernism, because I think everything serves a politic. So these are color pencil drawings. These are wrapping paper with pro-choice pins photographed. In the wrapping paper, you can show the detail. Next. This is wrapping paper that's repeated. It's drawn, though, color pencil. I think it's almost 9 foot wide, and then there's a pro-choice in it, my body, my choice. Next. There, that one, that's just an installation. I went to the AIDS Memorial quilt, where it's in storage, and so I did a video and drawing installation books, but these are drawings based on what they want to happen with the quilt at this point. They want it to continue to be an activist tool, but reflect the people who are getting AIDS today and who are dying of AIDS today, which is more than 50% are women and women and people of color. So I was combining, I was trying to make drawings that might reflect quilts, just quilts that reflected this idea. So these are all drawings of quilts or sections of quilts. So you can just look at some of the details. Next. That was made by a famous African-American quilter. This is, you can go next. This is, the all. Everything was based on the size of the quilts. I think they're 3 by 6 feet, something like that. They're the size of a grave. So this piece of paper was the size of one AIDS memorial quilt or the size of a grave, but these were the stacks of, these were images of stacks of quilts, and I was thinking about this in terms of the American flag, and I was really focused on the point that the quilt was being silenced because people weren't showing it as much, so it was like the silencing of the disease again. Next. This is a piece about Marla Ruzicka and Felice Ali Salim. They started an organization in Iraq and Afghanistan. Marla was from Northern California, and they were going door to door, counting, trying to get an accurate number of the civilians who were killed in Afghanistan and Iraq. So they were going door to door. So she was this beautiful, young, 20-something blonde woman from Northern California, so she obviously needed a partner to do this. So she had an Iraqi partner. They were not a couple. He was married, but it's really important work. And she died. They were both killed in a car bomb in Iraq. And I don't know, 2007 maybe. So at that moment, I heard about it and I downloaded all the kind of like internet eulogies or reports of this that are one or two pages that told the story. And I wanted to make a work about Marla, but I didn't feel like I could because Faiz was never mentioned or hardly mentioned. This just showed at the New Museum. So what I did was I drew these articles twice. The negative space is hand-drawn. The white is the white of the paper. And any image or photograph, I hand-drew that. So the left panel of drawings is the whole article. The right panel of drawings only mentions or only illustrates those texts that mention Faiz, her partner. So we can look at those. You can just sort of whiz through those. Those are the full texts. Those are the texts with just the info on Faiz. So here you can see a set of four together. And then there's some details. I mean, that's super blown up. This is Elvira Arellano. She was arrested as a terrorist in Chicago. She had migrated to the United States. She was working in Chicago cleaning airports for $6.50 an hour because her father was very ill. She was sending half of her paycheck back to him in Mexico, and she got pregnant and has a young son. She was given deportation papers, and her son was born in America. So she felt that Salito's rights were being taken away by her being deported. So she went into sanctuary in a church in Chicago. So I went there and made a film about her and visited her and followed her story. So this is her with her shirt on. Next. I think it's pretty self-descriptive. Okay, explanatory. This is an organization called Step It Up that was prior to Bill McKibben's 350 that's current right now. This was in 2007. This is about global warming. Color pencil. There's a detail of it. Next. I've been obsessed with tree sitters for a while, the people who get in trees and protest. Earth First, et cetera, et cetera. This is a very ironic photo for me because I was sort of thinking about it as a kind of like self-portrait, and I never knew what would happen next, which was I got in a tree and got arrested a couple of weeks ago, and now I'm being prosecuted, and it's pretty brutal. So anyway, this is actually a drawing of a Xerox from an Earth First manual. Next. This is one of my favorite. This is a page from Earth First, and it says, the text says, Mommy said never talk to fucking cops. Next. This goes back, feminist history, promises. I mean, for me, I just see art as this giant history vault, and like, what are the images I want to see in it? And I actually see it as a really useful political tool. Next. And of course, with Emily, I totally agree on sort of like, you know, memorializing. Also, I have one of my best friends is a single mom. She's 46, a single mom, and she's really struggling with the current politics of child rearing. She takes a lot of criticism for being a working mom and an artist. And so I did this drawing for her. The text, go ahead. My mommy works and I'm fine. Next. This is quick, huge drawing series. These are 500 names of people who've died crossing the Mexican-American border. This is, each drawing is 10 feet tall, 50 feet wide. I did not make money off this drawing. I asked for the production costs back, and the rest of the money is donated to the person who gave me the names, Enrique Morones. He's an activist. He has an organization called Border Angels. He collected the names, and they started in 86, leaving water and food at the border for people crossing out in the desert. Next. That's a poster of a grape. Next, you can just run through these. And then this was the recent May Day immigration march in Los Angeles, and you can just run through those. This was when Arizona was doing the show me your papers, you know, legislation. (Clears throat) This is Tim DeChristopher. His trial is February 28th. He went in during the last week of the Bush month of the Bush administration. Bush was going to auction off all this beautiful land in Utah for oil and gas drilling. So Tim went in and bid on all the land without any money, and he won $2.5 million worth of land and something like, I don't know, thousands and thousands of acres. But the sales were canceled, but he is still being prosecuted by the Obama administration. PeacefulUprising.com. Go and support him. Next. This was one of your congressional representatives. I was thinking about the fact how everyone was so into Hillary Clinton running for president, and I just wanted to remind people that Shirley Chisholm and Angela Davis both ran for president. Angela ran for vice president, so I just did some drawings of their political buttons. This is the last details.
Hello. I have to keep on reminding myself to speak up. So I'm an English man, and I've come over from the north of England. It's where I'm from and where I still live. I live in the northeast on the coast, around a town of Middlesbrough. Its wider community is known as sort of Teesside. It's on the River Tees, and it's an area in the UK which is particularly unfashionable. It's quite a forgotten kind of place. I should tell you which is my work in this show. And my work is the set of 12 drawings over there, with the model in front, on the table. And I said that I wouldn't just talk about the site, so maybe if I try to just split my time between talking about the site and the place from which this piece of work is inspired, and then half the time about this relationship to drawing practice and you know, how I see drawing and why. You know, some of the themes of the show, really, you know. That's the first slide is a kind of view from the train journey. My hometown is a place, like I said, by the sea, Saltburn by the sea, and it's on the end of the line. It's like a commuter line which takes you into Darlington, where you can change onto the main line. It goes through Middlesbrough, and on the way you really bypass and go through you know, a lot of the industrial landscape of the of Teesside. So just to give you a little flavor, you know, we have a petrochemical works, the largest in Europe. We have a steelworks, the blast furnace at Redcar, nearby Redcar, is the largest in Europe. We have an oil refinery on the north side of the Tees. We have a nuclear power station. We kind of have a footprint dominated by, you know, big industry. But just to give you some figures in terms of just some bold figures, 4 out of 10 people are workless in the area. Claimant unemployment is double the national average. 43% of people in jobs or in the public sector. There's no real entrepreneurial kind of thing. And six of the 23 wards are in the lowest 1% for social deprivation in the UK. So May 2009, the particular site of the steelworks, which is the one closest to the train journey, or closest to the track, as a particular became a kind of site of worker unrest and the usual sort of protest kind of situation, the placards and marches, and 2,000 people had just got notified that they're going to lose their jobs because a consortium had pulled out of a 10-year contract, and the actual redundancies were in February 2010, but then the notification of this was happening, early summer, and I wanted to dedicate a kind of piece of work, a summer's work, to my particular relationship to this site. And the train journey, the piece documents the sort of 12 seconds of the train journey as you pass the coke ovens, which are on the right, and the boss plant, which is on the left-hand side of the track. And boss is a basic oxygen supply. That's what you can see to the left. So I'm kind of, if you imagine yourself on the track heading out of Saltburn into Middlesbrough, you have the, I mean, we can flick onto the next one. The proportion of the plant in relation to the immediate neighborhood of Grangetown. It kind of has these cathedral-esque properties. The track is on the other side, so this wasn't a sort of fleeting glance. Next one. This is the kind of view you get up close as the train sort of, arcs its way around. Next one. And the thing about it, the scale of the thing is something to behold. And what I try to do on my 12 seconds is kind of make a representation of this form as best I could from my vantage point on the train. So that it wasn't a kind of static kind of psychogeography, if you like. Psychogeography is kind of a useful analogy of the sort of process of trying to recreate this site. Next one, please. And so these are all my photographs. To the right, you had the coke ovens, which is where the coal is heated up to rid its kind of impurities, and then it's used in the process, in the Bessemer kind of process. And so the journey, the train goes right up close, and you see the coke ovens in relief. So, one of the things about this these buildings is that they dialogue very much with kind of modernism and high modernist sort of. I had this kind of idea that I was going to do a volumetric study and a kind of study of this sort of heavy relief. I also kind of had I have a digital sort of little thing, and also an old Praktika camera, which is an old East German make, which I've had for years and years. And these, the black and whites are the ones on the Praktika, and it's just interesting to contrast, Well, I've got some of the, these are original, that's some of the original photos are coming up, and they were mainly digital. It was just I've been taking photographs of it for a long, long time, up until the summer. It was kind of, I'd go past it on a regular basis. So that was one of the... can we just flip back? Can you see the guy, bottom right? Looking into the furnace. So you get a sense of the scale. I think the boss plant, something like, stands 300 into the... I mean, but the coke ovens, I mean, yeah, these guys are... Can you see that? The little fella?
Yeah, it's amazing.
Mm. I mean, yeah. Do you want me to talk? I should talk about the drawing thing. But if we move on to the next one. So this is one of the this represents the far right on the piece and the original photograph. And I should just tell you. I started drawing as a teenager. You know, in my bedroom, probably like a lot of teenagers with no sort of ambition necessarily to be an artist, but teenagers difficult kind of, you know, sort of disaffected. I mean, I found myself spending a lot of time up there. It was just a little bedroom. I had my first kind of archive of images, which was sort of, you know, pop stars, and so I covered my bedroom walls and then drew the pop stars. But I mean, I'd from an early age a kind of suspicion of patriarchy and matriarchy, and I mean essentially sort of systems of governance and power, so as a way of killing time, I guess that was my first sort of art activity. But I mean, you don't actually think of anything like, I mean, you know, at the time it's quite unselfconscious, and it's only later in time that you maybe realize the effects of these things, and you go on to study art. And I mean, I continued a drawing practice as a kind of backbeat, as a kind of, you know, I guess what has developed is this sort of situation of, you know, this sort of seriality or a dailiness or a day-to-day practice, a studio practice, which I can rely on. And then I've less reliable on more sort of sculptural things and prototypes. So this idea of there's a seriality and a maybe one-off projects. And so I've like Andrea, I've had a kind of relationship to two-dimensional work and three-dimensional work, which is left, you know, sort of and also the investigation of sites. So some of the first shows I did were in council flats and working men's clubs, and there was this kind of political... And these were the things that I was drawn towards, and also when I was studying art, I was kind of into artists like Robert Smithson and Gordon Matter-Clark, who had a, you know, that sort of social... So I just wanted, you know, I mean, the thing about drawing, I mean, there's just... If I just... It's maybe best if I just kind of throw some... I mean, I kind of... Yeah, just some bullet type points, something to do with... I mean, there's a couple of key texts for me have been Martin Heidegger, Building, Dwelling, Thinking, and a book that we've been both reading, Tyranny of the Moment, Fast and Slow Time in the Information Age. This idea of killing time, of losing time, of knowing things better because of a kind of radical observation. This killing time thing, you know, that the process of making, you start in the morning, you lose yourself in time, and there's a compression. I mean, 3 hours later, you don't know where it's gone. The repetitive thing has been quite useful for me. I am interested in, you know, this idea of the automatic and second nature, you know, things where you start to do things and it becomes like second nature, it becomes unconscious, and for me it's kind of a repetitive thing, and there's probably Freudian things to do, texts that talk about repetition like that. No, but the idea to dwell is a fairly political idea, I think, in terms of the information age and the fastness of things. So, I've written down architectural control. So maybe withdrawing, you have a bit more control.
That's a good sort of entree point, you know, into the panel generally. I think something that some of you have touched on that does seem to be consistent for a lot of the artists in the show is that desire to have this kind of studio practice or something that you can count on every day, that you go in, and that I know you've talked about this, Carl, that you sort of know you're going to go in and that you're going to, at the end of the day, you're going to come out with something. And I'm interested in, and I think it was Emily who said that you felt that that sort of your own personal kind of gesture of spending time with something was a political act. And I think you mentioned that too, that there was something political in that kind of, in your own private action of dwelling with something. So maybe we could talk a little bit about that, and then sort of thinking about that notion of political, you know, can something be political if it's just your own sort of personal private action? Or, you know, or do you think, and Andrew could speak to this, you know, that it is also having some larger effect in the world? How does that relate, your own kind of personal political gesture of making, relate to the subject matter that you're choosing to depict, which often does have kind of, you know, sort of political, you know, complications, or this particular plant, there was a lot of sort of controversy surrounding it. You know, does that factor into the types of things you choose to present? And maybe also, Andrea, how do you think about your kind of more activist practice, such as, you know, sitting in the tree, in relationship to your drawing practice? Do they have the same effect? I know that's a big question, but does someone want to sort of jump into that?
I could talk about the labor aspect.
Okay.
That I spend many, many hours drawing, and I love it. It's very meditative. But I realize, like, in this particular drawing, if you think about the history of Marxism, the history of communism, it's all about labor, you know? And Marx talks about, in Capital, about how you know, the masses are, people are alienated from their labor. And I'm not, I love, in a sense, symbolically sort of acting out a connection to labor through my own labor. If we think about labor as people who work in factories or people who farm, but they're so abstract to me, you know? And it's not, I realized a while ago that I can really only do this at a symbolic level, that I could associate myself with sort of a cause or a belief through this, but it really was staying in the studio, and in a way that, like, I can reconnect myself. I can not be alienated from my labor. Like, I go there every day and I see the product of what I do, and I have control over it, and that's kind of wonderful. But I don't want it to have any sort of effect greater than at a symbolic level. And it also, you know, drawing is, it's very tactile, it's very close, it's very human, it's very, I mean, I was saying how it's very sexual, because particularly in relation to photography, and I know Andrea says this too, like, we only draw things of images that we love. I draw images that I love. And it's sort of like going over the surface slowly by slowly. It's very sexual to kind of, like, rub each surface and sort of spend time with each one and get to know each surface. But then again, it's ineffectual. It is masturbatory too. Like, I mean, it takes longer drawing, but it's at the end you're left with something somewhat benign. You know, it's just a drawing. And I like the poetry of that too, that when it's all over, it is still just a piece of paper. You know?
What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think there's the personal, and then there's how the object functions in the world. So I think for me personally, I think when I was a kid growing up, I had a bit of a learning disability, and the only way I could study was to copy everything I was supposed to memorize. Mm-hmm. And I think that process translated into me making these types of drawings in a way. And so there's a sense of empathy I have. I was not a political person. I grew up, you know, with a Republican family. I grew up during Vietnam, you know, on television when I was a kid. I didn't believe in individual voice or voting or any of those things. So I think in a way I've taken this way of learning through recording into also having a political voice. So the imagery, I kind of empathize with the imagery. On a bigger picture, I think when you're asking me about activism and art, I think that there are two aspects of activism. One is theoretical, one is actual, you know, one is action. And I think that also in an action or in a political movement, there's all sorts of different roles, which I'm now learning. Directly. But there's frontline activists, and I think that's what everybody thinks an activist is. But for a frontline activist to accomplish anything, you have to have somebody who does the media. You got to have somebody who, you know, I don't know, organizes. You got to have somebody who records. So I've found how important my work has been to these activists. Because, yeah, it shows in the art world, but it also functions in other ways, too, particularly the video. Actually, the drawing, too. So I think that bearing witness is a really important thing because it's really horrible to be an activist and nobody records what you've done. Like, it's a crucial, crucial role. And kind of through the art world, I've had a great success at getting information out, you know, because we're all about representations and we're really good at the spectacle in a certain way, which Haka talked about. Mm-hmm. So that's my...
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're saying, I mean, I think this idea that kind of looking at something and receiving something and contemplating something can be a form of action, that action doesn't have to mean that you're kind of going out there and actually, you know, that's an important part.
Everybody's got a different role.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Emily, do you want to, because I know you had mentioned talking about this before, so.
Yeah, well, I would just clarify that I absolutely don't think that this work does politics. And when I only meant that it was a gesture that is protesting, if anything, the way that we are disassociated from this information, and that this is a process through which to slow down the experience of this information. My politics are not liberal, they're more radical. And so I happen to think that art and activism are almost mutually exclusive. I think that they can blend and or work for each other at times, like in some of Andrea Bauer's projects that she talked about. But I think that generally doing politics or doing good politics requires an utmost clarity of message. And if you're going to make any kind of political demand to the powers that be, it can't be ambiguous. It needs to be really clear. And I think that that same criteria does not apply to, at least in my mind, what makes engaging art, because that would be didactic in the case of art, which to me is not as moving as something that is ambiguous. So I think the two things are very different in my mind.
Do you want to say anything about your relationship, or if you?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of drawing or a studio practice versus a more public sphere, there are certain. I mean, everybody kind of, you know, is aware of the sort of personality types. You know, I mean, art is a broad church. You know, and everybody should be able to fit and have a voice in this kind of thing. I mean, I feel particularly politicized, but I also feel like an introvert, and this is a clash. You know, that I never, as a student, I mean, there were plenty of marches and plenty of opportunities, but I mean, somehow when all those artists were talking about breaking out studios and what have you, I mean, I'm at home when I'm in the studio, you know, and so there's this conflict maybe, and it might even, you know, that sort of, you know, sort of re-energize or you know, the idea of the studio, that it could be, you know, potentially a radical site if artists, you know, enough artists are living in buildings or, you know, working in bedrooms, this kind of thing, you know, especially in I suppose, cities at the minute, I don't live in a city because it's just too expensive, we have regenerational models in UK, and what it means is the artists sort of end up, further and further out. But the intimacy or the kind of the drawing activity, my thing is, the other thing about A4 or A3 size or trying to appropriate a kind of scale which is maybe familiar to like sort of photocopy realism and instead of photorealism or like poor quality computer print with little imperfections and horizontal lines. I got interested in that and ranges of sort of furniture intended for schools and corporate headquarters and drawing on those and
what's photocopy realism?
Well, that's a good almost like a photocopy.
Yeah.
And noticing how these things look and how they are, and that's maybe different to
A photograph.
And the A4 sort of the homage to an A4, which is actually a nice, it's kind of a nice sort of 2-3 proportion anyway. So the scale suited to the possession or trying to the human is really the tradition of the hand and of craft is far more of a humanizing tradition in the face of forces which are you feel kind of out of your control, especially as an introverted sort of personality, so.
I find it very interesting that kind of relationship between your own, again, your own need to kind of find control for yourself personally and your sense that this kind of control is missing in the world at large. That is something, and in a way there, I think, becomes the kind of the larger act. So maybe since we don't have so much time left, we should open it up to the audience and see if anyone has any questions for the artists. So, yes.
Not yet. I'm kind of more interested in what's going on in Wisconsin. it's really hard for me. I think I'm interested in like the local versus the universal. And I think that there's a lot of local events that have kind of universal application in a way, like the border, right? Like there's like the Greeks are trying to build a border now to keep out because they're the gateway to the Eastern or the EU. I'm from the Midwest, so I feel like I understand what's going on in Wisconsin more, and I could actually go there, but I'm so excited kind of about what's going on in Egypt, but I'm not there. Mm-hmm. I feel like I have to embed myself in a location and really get to know the subject before I can speak about it too much. Mm-hmm. But I think it has a application more universally.
Yeah. I mean, one of the artists in the show who, I don't know if she's still in the audience, I guess she's not. She was here, I saw her at the beginning of the talk, Mary Temple. Her project on the other side of this wall is filled with Egypt. So if you want to go over there and look, her project, she actually has an ongoing project called Currency in which every day she scans, and she's actually been doing this since 2004 too. So I don't know if there was something about 2004. I mean, there was something about 2004. Yeah. She scans internet news reports and chooses the story that sort of interests her from that day. And then chooses a photograph of the world leader who is represented by that story, one of many photographs of that leader from that day, draws the portrait of that leader on the page and places the drawing according to her sort of feelings about the possibilities for world peace. So it's high up on the page, she's feeling optimistic, low down on the page, not so optimistic, and then she sort of writes an amalgamation of the headlines.
And so on the opposite wall here, you have the month of February, I'm sorry, you have the month of January, sort of the archive from the month of January, and then every day, the 7 days of the week, which changes every day, and she actually does the drawing, scans it, emails it to us, and we print it out. And so every day it's changing. So you actually have a record of the news. So if you don't get a chance to read the paper, you can come to the drawing center and find out what's going on. But it's very interesting because there's the Mubarak is all over the month of January, and now it has kind of moved out of the week, but perhaps will come back in at some point. So anyway, any other questions? Yeah, Carter.
Sure. I think that it was not that self-conscious. In a sense, I'm just drawing the best I can and doing these as well, as close to the photograph as I can. And also, just by necessity, I've at this point done over 5,000 drawings. And so there's a scale of time that comes in. Like if I was going to be, I wouldn't be able to do this project and keep up with it if I was trying to do drawings at that level of realism. And I think that what Andrea said was really interesting about taking the ego out of it by really replicating the appearance of the photograph. And I think mine is kind of in the middle somewhere, because I am interested in having a human hand in it that is not like overly stylized, but is just my own authentic drawing hand, so that you like feel that touch when you're looking at it.
But the two questions are related. It's sort of interesting how, because the more realistic or the more time-consuming or photorealistic, I should say, the drawing, the more time it takes, therefore it has to have less currency in terms of like up-to-dateness. Mm-hmm. If we look at these drawings, because you can't.
Right.
It's sort of like the question about Cairo. If I make a work about Cairo, by the time I'm done, there's another revolution happening in another country.
It took like 5 months to make that drawing.
Right. So and this is the Civil War. So it's sort of something interesting about the nature of drawing, how it could be very, quick. I could render some. I can draw something really quickly now, and it could be about Cairo. But if I want to render it out photographically, it's going to take months and months. So, this is sort of like up-to-date practice is drawn a certain way, and it can have a certain kind of currency. And then, but that's something very fundamental to the nature of drawing, that if you want to really get into it laboriously, it can't really be current in a topical sense. Mm-hmm.
Did you have a question? Oh, sorry. Yes, the Civil War photograph in drawing took him 5 months.
I'm interested in the generational aspect of younger artists using technical or digital media as source material for your work, as opposed to something, some of my generations can have the generative abstract expressionism, for example, where it's all about expressing your idea about something and feelings about something. Mm-hmm. That's something that you share.
Well, I would say that that's where my overlap is with the idea of subtracting the ego in the sense of the making a work about my own interior psychic landscape I'm really not interested in. I'd much rather be doing something about the outside world that's a learning process for me at the same time.
Can I just,
just wanted to say something about a generation of people born in, say, the 70s and a relationship to the baby boomers. And my mum and dad were baby boomers, and somebody mentioned about how they talk about the 60s all the time as, you know, 68 and all this kind of thing. And I mean, as young artists growing up and studying art, you know, I mean, I for one kind of got a little bit sick of being told that I'm pretty irrelevant, you know. And everything's been done, and now, you know, everything's kind of dead, and, you know, the death of this, death of the author, death of, you know. So, I mean, I think it does chime with that in that sense. And I think there's a lot of texts out there now about, you know, baby boomers and the housing economy, for example, or the baby boomers and the pleasure principle. So this unfettered story of the last 50 years of, let's say, just the idea that in society that it's been pretty much a story of reconstruction after the, you know, after the Second World War, certainly in Europe. And it's been a story of the baby boomers, and it's not necessarily been a story of the 1970s or the kids in the 1980s, you know.
I'll say something about that as well. I think Andrew and I were actually talking about this before. First, certainly this work is very different than the kind of self-expression or the idea that, you know, that the abstract expressionists were involved in self-expression. But I think it's also different than, say, the pictures generation. And again, I'm talking about the way these things have been perceived, or the way the pictures generation is perceived as, you know, and sort of as being involved in this death of the author, as you were talking about. In this case, it's almost, I mean, you all, I think, care deeply about the work that you are drawing. I mean, you said that as well. You know, you love them, as you are doing this because you wanted to sort of find a way of connecting with this, with what was going on. You are from this place that you are drawing. Andrea, you feel very deeply about these activists that you're depicting. So, the subject is not at all voided, or your identity is not at all voided, but it's sort of a different model of identity in a way, one in which, you know, the self is expressed in that belief in and commitment to something, rather than in their judgment about something or feelings about something. So it's in a way a different kind of model of authorship, I think. But certainly your self is kind of present in a way. Anyway.
Well, for me, it's not about the psychology, right. It's about the intellect, mm-hmm. Right? I mean, that's conceptualism, mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's really important, because I think that I think that modernism was a focus on a patriarchal psychology that a lot of us don't fit in, so therefore I'm attempting an alternative model.
Mm-hmm. But isn't it wonderful? I love how it's sort of the fact that all of us love our subject matter,
right.
I love how that is the connection between the personal and the subject matter, right. And why those identifications are formed. Why do we love that? Why do all of us love it here, and we're sitting here, and how do we all come here to share that belief?
Well,
that's an interesting question.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to be taking the time, I mean, I think that also goes back to the labor of drawing. If you're going to be spending that much time with something, you would probably
You better like the subject matter.
Yeah, right.
I don't actually like sitting and drawing.
Interesting.
I hate it. I want to be at a party. I want to be out, you know, whatever. I hate it.
You really feel dedicated to what you're drawing.
Yeah. I mean, I like what the finished product, but I don't enjoy the process anymore.
Mm-hmm. Which is different than Richard and Carl. I don't know about you, Emily, but
it depends. It depends day to day.
Yeah.
It can be really hard. Yeah. Or it can be great. Or you can have a lot of snacks.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I was just going to say that Richard's piece, I'm speaking for you, sorry, is called A Rehearsed Inability to Know This Unplaced. So right there in that title, you know, you're acknowledging that you are not really achieving what you are kind of setting up to present.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, yeah, I mean, the idea of place and knowing about sight and someone's belonging or sense of belonging or non-belonging, I mean, is very relevant in these, in this particular landscape. And I kind of, before I embarked on the, you know, the commitment of doing the work, I kind of knew that I was supposed to know that, you know? I think if you break that down, the idea of rehearsal, the idea to know, and then the idea to, you know, of place and sight in relation to, say, modernism, you know, that's actually, there's three big chunks of philosophical kind of debate. So, you know, the idea of rehearsal, I always think, is, you know, is somehow, yeah, it's like... again, it's got that ideas of what is the real, you know, that you rehearse something because you kind of, you know, you're leading up to something, or it's kind of, it's not the real thing, it's kind of me dressing something up, you know. And yeah, I mean, you know, I suppose... tied to the idea of to know is this idea of observation, you know, so this sort of idea of radical observation, that it will still leave you somewhere short. And I think there's visual and way, you know, ways of trying to come to terms with that. So for instance, on a different day, you know, the weather's totally different, you may have a camera shake, or, you know, this kind of, there's sometimes a few you know, like trains or tram, you know, sort of things in your view. There's an element of instability and chance, and, you know, built into the structure of how you want to work. So there's that question of having a hypothesis and testing it. So there's that sort of notion of an ultimate truth or a scientific truth. And the rehearsed inability to sort of really, you know, which I think is, again, in terms of an idea, like to say that the sort of the futurists and these kind of shift, you know, they were obsessed with speed, and in the turn of the 20th century, a lot of these ideas were kind of, you know, about fragmentation, and that was in my mind a lot as well, certainly in relation to industry, you know, and I don't know. Is that answering the question?
Yeah.
In terms of what they're doing, I wouldn't want to answer that question for them. For me, when you ask about my responsibility, do you mean to an audience?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. To me, that's a really thorny question. I'm not sure what my responsibility is to the audience. I suppose the gesture in this, implicit in this process itself, is one of paying witness to these people, and on its most fundamental level, to me, it's a gesture of respect of through witness. I'm afraid that's as close as I can get to answering your question. I'd have to really think about that.
Any other questions? Okay. I'll just say one thing and then we'll close. But just, it was interesting to me, Emily, because I remember when we talked about this project, you had said that you did not ask, or, you know, I actually asked you, did you ask the family members for photographs when they were not available? And you said that you hadn't because you didn't feel like you wanted to kind of, in a way, insert yourself that directly, or to kind of ask anything of these people who were grieving in this way. But it sounds like you actually did, there were some relationships with people.
Yeah, I never asked, but some people, there's a website that has an archive of all these images, mm-hmm. so when some people found out about the project, they went to find mm-hmm. the picture of their loved one and discovered, oh, there mm-hmm. isn't one. And then they contacted me and said, we have a picture for you, mm-hmm. and I was okay. like, great, and we had a really mm-hmm. beautiful dialogue back and forth. Mm-hmm. But right, I never wanted to ask any favors yes. of people in like really recent bereavement.
Right, and I think that might speak to what you're saying about responsibility. I mean, she didn't. I don't think she, in a way, she took what was available to anyone on this website. You know, you didn't go in there and sort of intervene and try and kind of get behind the scenes. She really just took what was there. You know, which I think is a different, which all these artists are doing in a way. So that's, if there are no further questions, we will conclude here. And thank you all so very much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you, honey.
Thank you so much.